I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include The French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. He is the author of 4 cookbooks, including The French Laundry Cookbook. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
It took you quite a few years before you bought the French Laundry and your career really took off. You held various cooking positions in Florida, Rhode Island, Catskill in upstate New York. You apprenticed in France. You then went from your first restaurant called Raquel in New York City to another restaurant in Los Angeles. And finally, you landed in Yountville in the Napa Valley. How did you find the French Laundry?
I was in Los Angeles at the time. I was dating a woman who was a wine broker in Los Angeles. Of course, many of her wineries were in Napa Valley. So I would travel with her to Napa Valley probably twice a month. And at that time, there was a chef, colleague, friend from New York City, Jonathan Waxman, who was opening his first restaurant outside of New York in California called Table 29. And during construction, I stopped by to see him one day on one of my trips. He knew I wasn't working. He said, Thomas, there's this restaurant in Yountville called The French Laundry, and I know it's for sale, and I think it'd be perfect for you. And so that was really the catalyst that started the process. And I went to Yountville. I walked on the property of The French Laundry and just emotionally resonated with me. I felt like this was the place.
By the way, this girlfriend, the wine broker, is this the woman whom you started an olive oil company with called Evo in 1992?
Exactly. Yeah, Diane Harder. Exactly. Yeah. Diane and I started an olive oil company called Evo. It was a time when I wasn't working and I was trying to find other avenues from a culinary point of view where I could have an impact.
There's a quote in the French Laundry cookbook which resonated with me. When you first discovered the French Laundry, you said, I gave the French Laundry a new life, and it gave me a new life. And that implies a level of sadness prior to the French Laundry. Was there sadness in your life or restlessness prior to that?
Well, there was certainly a great sense of uncertainty in my life. New York, when I was in New York at Raquel, you know, this city was my home. It was the center of the universe. I never thought I would ever leave New York City. I was emotionally and physically committed to Raquel. And, of course, when that failed, I was set adrift, didn't really know what to do. I spent a year in New York trying to find some connection to something, really didn't, and ended up in L.A. I went out there to be the chef at Checkers Hotel. A great hotel. We got great exposure. It was a great success. But ultimately, that was a failure for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was set adrift again in L.A. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. Was I destined to be a chef? Was I cut out to be a chef? As much as I love cooking, as much as I love the fact of nurturing people through food. So the French Laundry was kind of my last effort. Mm-hmm. If that didn't work, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Why do you think Raquel didn't work out?
There's a number of different things. Certainly, you know, at that time in New York, which was the mid-80s, I mean, it was just booming. Americans were learning about French cuisine, about fine dining, and certainly Raquel was a version of that at that moment. Raquel was downtown in a new area, Hudson Square. My partner, Serge Raoul, who owns Raoul's, certainly had great experience in New York and certainly great experience downtown. I had just come back from France, learning about French food, living there, learning really in the detail of French food. And it was a great success for the first 4 years. I mean, the restaurant was 6 years old by the time we closed it. And then, of course, the area didn't develop as that was predicted to develop. We had certainly the stock market downturn. But I think one of the big reasons is I really didn't understand how to run a restaurant. And from that moment on, I knew that if I was going to have another restaurant, if I was going to be lucky enough to have another restaurant in my life, I needed to have individuals involved in that restaurant that knew more than I did about finance, knew more than I did about running a dining room. I was a chef, you know, and a lot of chefs think they can do everything. I realized at that moment at Raquel, at great expense, personal expense, financial expense, that I didn't know everything I needed to know.
I've heard you say that one of the appeals to cooking is the immediate gratification that you get. But looking at your history, it seems like your life has been more of one of a patient gardener, a gardener who has to tolerate the erratic nature of the weather and other components out of one's control. What is your temperament?
It's interesting when you say patience. I learned patience relatively later in life, and a big part of that came to me when I was trying to put together the financial structure for the French Laundry and buying the French Laundry. I would call my attorney every day and ask him if there was any news. And finally one day he said, Thomas, listen, I'll call you when there's news. And I had to keep myself busy, and I had to learn to be patient. And then, of course, persistence. I mean, I sit here today as a true example of somebody who was persistent.
You talk about patience in the kitchen, and in your cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, you talk about being mindful about cutting an artichoke. What are some other examples of your being mindful of the mundane in the kitchen?
Cooking is repetition, and I think that as cooks, you have to be comfortable with knowing that you're going to be doing the same thing your entire career. And of course, that's going to change and evolve, but at the basis of what you're doing, you're cooking, whether it's sautéing or braising or roasting or chopping or slicing or dicing, plating food. I mean, all the poaching, even the new sous vide technology that we're using in the kitchen, all those, once you've mastered them, once you've learned them, you're going to be doing them. They're part of the daily routine. They're part of your daily structure. Repetition, in many ways, liberates you to be working on other things. I mean, I've cleaned salmon so many times before that I don't really have to focus on cleaning the salmon. It's almost like muscle memory, and I can be thinking about more other things, like what am I going to do with the salmon when I get it cleaned?
Have you been influenced by any religion that has helped you be more mindful? Because you're talking as somebody who might do yoga or meditation, or even, you know, Judaism is about the present. So there's a lot of religious spiritual components to what you're talking about.
People have said that to me before. As a young boy, I went to Catholic school, and one of the things I did every day was be an altar boy at Mass, and that was something, 7 a.m. Mass, I was there, you know, 5 days a week or 6 days a week, because then it was also Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really have much, later in life, I didn't have a strong connection to religion, and certainly meditation or any kind of spiritual enlightenment is not part of my... never been part of my life, really. So right. I'm not sure where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He's the first American chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars for both of his fine dining restaurants, the French Laundry in Napa Valley, California, and Per Se in New York City. You spent your early life in California before moving to Florida. Your parents were divorced. Your father was a Marine drill instructor, and he left your mother when you were 5 or 6 years old with you and your 4 brothers.
Correct.
What influence did your father's absence in your life have on you?
My mother and father didn't have a very good separation, so they didn't part on friendly terms. So, you know, growing up, and I was 4 years old when they separated, so my whole life was with my mother and my brothers. Mm-hmm. My father wasn't really part of it. He was somebody who lived in Pennsylvania. I don't want to say I didn't have any need for him, but I didn't have an apparent need for him. I certainly had those father figures in my older brothers. They were my role models. They were my teachers, you know, from a masculine point of view. And my mother was there. My mother was an amazing person, very dedicated, committed to her children and their well-being. And she ran restaurants. So she was gone in many evenings, which left the older brothers, my older brothers, to kind of cook mm-hmm. for us and babysit us, which was fine. But I didn't grow up on, you know, sitting on my mother's knees during the polenta or my grandmother's, you know, in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, mm-hmm. baking biscuits. But as I started to grow older, I spent more and more time at the restaurant. And I really enjoyed those moments in my mother's restaurant, in those kitchens.
When you say your mother's restaurant, mm-hmm. she was a restaurant manager of an existing restaurant
exactly.
in Florida.
She didn't own the restaurant. She ran the restaurants, yes.
What are some of those early memories that you have with her in the restaurant?
Well, you know, the restaurants are very nurturing places. And at the same time, kitchens can be very violent places. Mm-hmm. So you have this real dichotomy between these two environments. You have these individuals in there who are continuously cooking for people and nurturing them. But at the same time, you have sharp knives, you have wet floors, you have steam, you have heat, you have all these different things going on. So you really have to be aware in a kitchen. And I think awareness was key for me. And I think that was one of the great things I learned early on from my mother and being in those kitchens was a sense of awareness of everything that's around me and being careful.
Hmm. When you were with your mother in those earlier years, did you have thoughts of, you know, this is where I want to make my life? When did that come to mature?
Well, I never thought about being a chef in those early days. When I did venture out on my own and have a job in the real world, which was in construction, my older brothers were in construction, so I kind of migrated towards that. But once I found my way back into the kitchen, and although I didn't realize it at that time, looking back at that moment washing dishes at the Palm Beach Yacht Club really prepared me to be a cook, because the actions that you are doing as a dishwasher, the same things that you're going to be doing as a cook. In other words, it's about organization. So as all the dirty dishes and silverware and glasses come in, you have to be extremely organized. You have to have them stacked correctly. You have to have them piled. You have to have the water ready for the silverware. You have to be efficient. So you have to be able to stack the plates up correctly or get the silverware done correctly so that you're efficient in your movement, so you're not wasting any time. You get instant feedback. You know, if you don't scrape the dishes correctly or spray them down correctly before they go in the dish machine, they come out dirty. Mm-hmm. And then you learn to be part of a team. And everybody in the restaurant relies on you. So those were four critical elements of being a really good dishwasher that you translate to being a really good cook.
Yeah. It was washing dishes that helped you realize, you know what, I can make a life in the kitchen. But you had a level of organization and almost compulsiveness for cleanliness and precision, even outside the kitchen, in your home growing up. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you were like in your own home?
Well, my mother was meticulous. I mean, the house had to be clean all the time. And you take your shoes off before you went inside, you know, I mean, at one point, I remember in my life, the furniture was covered in plastic wrap, you know, to protect the fabric. We all had chores every week. My brothers and I always had chores. And Joseph and I, being the youngest, would always have to do the chores of the oldest. I was the one that always had to clean the bathroom, and that was probably the most difficult and certainly the most... You really became aware of how clean it was.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. We'll hear more from Thomas coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include The French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. You weren't surrounded by, you know, this rich culinary life growing up in any way. How did that transition occur from, you know, washing dishes in a, you know, random restaurant with mm-hmm. your mom to actually acquiring this awareness of this whole other culinary world?
So if you think back at the Palm Beach Yacht Club, I was washing dishes. And one day my mother came to me and said, you know, Richard, who was the chef at the time, you know, Richard's going to leave in a couple weeks. So, you know, if you watch what he does, mm-hmm. we're going to make you the chef.
How old are you?
I was probably 19.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, this is interesting. But I did have a leg up. My brother Joseph was already in the profession. He had decided at a relatively young age, 12 or 13, that he really wanted to be a chef. And Richard did show me. He showed me how to make an omelet. He showed me how to, you know, grill a flank steak, make hamburgers, things like that. And that's really what basically it was. The most difficult thing I had to do every day was make a hollandaise sauce. And my brother Joseph was very influential in helping me do that.
But no formal training ever.
No formal training. But there was really not an option. There wasn't a lot of options back in 1974 for formal training. Cooking wasn't viewed as it is today. There was really not a whole lot of interest in becoming a chef.
You had the reputation of managing your kitchen as if you were a military marine drill instructor like your father. And it's almost trite to ask, you know, what parallels are there between you and your father? But how has that occurred to you?
Well, you're right. I mean, absolutely. There is a definite hierarchy in the kitchen. That hierarchy was defined by Augustus Escoffier in the turn of the 1900s.
Is this the Brigade system?
The Brigade system, yeah. So you have a brigade or brigade. I mean, brigade in French, brigade in America. And, I mean, there is you know, the hierarchy. There's the chef, who's the leader. Then there's the sous chefs, demi sous chefs, chef de parties, commis. So you have this real hierarchy of how the kitchen operates. And when you think about a kitchen, especially during service or most of the time, it's about command response. And when you think about it, that initial command really comes from the guest. Mm-hmm. You sit down at the table, you look at the menu, and you choose what you want to eat. And you tell the waiter. And that's your command. Then all of a sudden, as the chef, then you tell all the chef de parties what needs to be done. And they respond. So from a militaristic point of view, it's the same in the military. It's all about command response.
Was it striking to you that, my career is paralleling my father's to a large degree?
It was a little bit. I didn't really think about it until much later in life. Much later in life, my early 20s, when I really started to think about it, and I started to reach out to my father to reconnect with my father at that time in my life.
And when you did reach out to him, you really reconnected in a big way. Your father moved from Pennsylvania to California to be with you at the French Laundry.
Yes.
In Napa Valley. And he died after having a car accident about a year after?
About a year and a half after he arrived in Yountville. He had a horrific car accident that left him a quadriplegic. And that was one of the most challenging moments of my life is to prepare him to come home, his home in Yountville.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. He was awarded France's highest culinary decoration, the Légion d'Honneur, for popularizing French cuisine in America in 2011. So you found your home in the French Laundry, and it took you about 2 years to raise $1.5 million to get the restaurant off the ground. Who did you raise the capital from?
Yeah, it was $1.2 million. But, I mean, back then that was, you know, I mean, when you don't have any money, you know, a substantial amount of money was an enormous amount of money to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went through three different avenues to raise the money. One was a commercial bank loan, real estate loan. Although I realized that once I started to apply for the bank loans, the failure here in New York City came to be a problem. So I had to have my old partner Serge Raoul, who really went out on a limb for me financially, come back and satisfy some of the debt that was still outstanding at Raquel. Mm. So, you know, when you think about the people that are involved in your life and how they come to your aid in some of the most unpredictable ways. I mean, certainly we had a failed restaurant. We had parted ways. I was gone for 3.5 years, and all of a sudden I need him to come back and satisfy a financial debt for us. And so, you know, that was one of the first individuals that, you know, really stepped up to the plate to help. The second part was a small business administrative loan. And we were very fortunate that I was very fortunate at that time. President Clinton had just come into office. He was trying to re-energize the economy. So he funded the SBA in a significant way. And, you know, a white, middle-class, educated male was not the profile for the SBA prior to that. And then finally, the last component was going out to private individuals for private placement. And I reached out to probably over 400 people. And that was probably the most difficult part of my life, trying to sell this project. And out of 400, we had 50 people who finally signed a check. And that was the final straw that helped me buy the French Laundry.
And the French Laundry in the 1880s, when it was first built, was actually a bar.
Before Prohibition, it was opened as a saloon gambling brothel. Yountville, in that time, we have a veterans home there, which is the oldest veterans home in America, or in California, I'm sorry. And then what happened really is the state really got tired of all the problems they were having in Yountville, so they passed a law that there wasn't alcohol served within 2 miles of the veterans home. So that shut down Yountville. And that's when a young French couple, bought the property. Yountville, Napa Valley at that time still was a place that many of the social elite from San Francisco would summer in. So their business model was to, you know, service all of these the socialites in their homes with the laundry service. And hence, that was where the French Laundry began.
After 10 years of French Laundry, you opened Per Se in 2004 in New York City. So you returned to the city that rejected you in the earliest days. How did that relationship with the Time Warner Center originate?
Time Warner Center was being developed by the Related Group. At that time, they were really looking towards France to come and occupy and build the restaurants there. At the same time, one or two of the French chefs that just arrived in America received some less than flattering reviews. So they kind of repositioned themselves and said, okay, let's not go to France. Let's look into America. And they reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in being one of their tenants. And I'd looked at New York once in a while, you know, mm-hmm. through the history of the French Laundry. You know, people would always say, when are you coming home? You know, home being New York City. If I was going to do another restaurant, another fine dining restaurant, there's really no other city in America to do it. And the Time Warner Center really offered us an opportunity to do it in a significant way.
You had a charmed life with French Laundry, but Per Se had an inauspicious start. There was a fire which mm-hmm. set you back. Can you talk to me about
the
that
fire.
Episode?
We opened the restaurant on February 19th in 2004, a little less than 10 years after we opened the French Laundry. And we had closed the French Laundry and brought 30 of those individuals to Per Se to help inoculate and train the new team. So we were off to a great start. And then on that, the 26th of February, it was right at staff meal. And I was in the butcher room with two of my sous chefs, and we were chatting. And we started to smell smoke. Then we started to see smoke. And that's when I evacuated the kitchen, the restaurant. We called the fire department. And that was basically what I thought was the beginning of end. And I stood there when that young fireman, you know, standing on top of the tables and just taking that big axe and going through the wall and the flame shooting out and water pouring out everywhere. And I thought, you know, I called my attorney and I said, I got to get out of here. But the next day we came back and, you know, we had a whole different attitude. We're going to now have a second chance to open this restaurant. And then I started getting cards from our Asian guests, and they were all flowers were coming and congratulations were coming, because in Asia, if you have a fire in your kitchen, it means you're going to be successful. So it's just, you know, it was a matter of point of view.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. I want to talk about just the experience of dining in the French Laundry or Per Se. The menus change every day in both restaurants. And you've said that you don't repeat any ingredients in the 9 courses. Is that true?
We repeat luxury ingredients. So there may be truffles twice, or there may be foie gras twice. But we would never have mushrooms twice, or carrots twice, or turnips twice, or things like that.
Do you think the clientele would really mind?
Well, you know, at some point, you know, as much as we appreciate and work for our guests, it's really about us. You know, it's about our values and our standards and challenging ourselves. And it was really a challenge in the beginning. Okay, we're not going to repeat any garnishes, any vegetables. Why would we? We're the French Laundry.
And we're going to have a new menu every day.
Right.
Can you walk me through some of the items on your menus that you are particularly fond of?
Some of the signature dishes, or some of the iconic dishes anyway, certainly the coronet of salmon. And what that is, it really looks like a miniature ice cream cone. And the inspiration from that ice cream cone, for that dish came from my experience eating ice cream cones.
At Baskin and Robbins.
Here in Chinatown, exactly. And that's where, when you think about awareness, how important awareness is, because you can look at something every day or every week or experience something over and over again and never really realize the full potential of what that is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that day in 1991 when I was at Baskin Robbins and the ice cream cone was put in front of me, did I see the coronet.
How about the oysters and pearls, which is another iconic offering of yours?
Exactly. It's one of those iconic dishes that is prepared every day. It was a purple box. And I was walking down the aisle of a grocery store and I saw a purple box. And on the purple box it said, you know, pearl tapioca. And I'm thinking, where do pearls come from? Pearls come from oysters. And therefore, you know, I bought a box of pearl tapioca, took it back to the French Laundry, and knew exactly what I was going to do with it. And there we have oysters and pearls.
And there is a level of playfulness on the menu at Per Se, mm-hmm. which seems surprising perhaps to people who go, because, oh, this is a fine dining establishment and they might expect it to be stuffier than it certainly is.
if you've experienced macaroni and cheese before, I think, which we all have, we can reinterpret that in a way that's going to be significant, and you're going to go, wow, that's just like the best macaroni and cheese I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Coffee and donuts, you know, is another one of those iconic dishes. And when you think about, yes, you know, fine dining restaurants historically have always been intimidating, and it's something that I don't want to represent in our restaurants. And so when you get that cornet, I mean, you have to smile. It's just so darn cute.
The law of diminishing marginal returns is important to you, and the idea is when you are giving people their food, you give them just enough to keep it interesting before they move on to the next.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and you think about the law of diminishing returns, it's something that came evident to me when I was a young person living in Florida, and we would go to the beach on Saturday and have beer. And at first, cold beer on a hot summer day was really amazing, really refreshing, really good. And, of course, by the time the second one came around, it was less, and the third one was even less so. And, you know, I translated that into the way I thought about food.
There's a comedian, Louis C.K. He says, yeah, you know, some people might eat until they're full and then move and then stop, but I eat until I'm ashamed. What are your own eating habits?
I try to eat healthy, of course. I don't try to eat a lot of food. I try, you know, in the morning, it's very ritualistic. Typically, I'll have some type of granola with chia seeds and some ground flaxseed, which I grind myself. Then I'll have my vitamin regimen with some juice or some probiotics, and then I'll have coffee. And then, you know, throughout the day, I typically eat with the team at the restaurant. I'm eating at 8 a.m. in the morning, at noon, and then again at 4:45, because that's when we serve our p.m. meal. So if I stay on that schedule, I feel really, really good.
I want to talk about your suppliers. You have more than 350 suppliers for the restaurant?
For the restaurant, yeah. You know, suppliers come and go depending on the season, depending on what they're growing, depending on where they are.
Can you provide some examples of your suppliers, some of the stories of your suppliers?
There are so many. Ingrid Benjes, who's in Stonington, Maine, who is accidental. I mean, she was an author. She moved to Maine, and she was trying to make a living. And she found some mushrooms and found a home for them at Balducci's here in New York. And they said, well, what else do you have? And she said, well, I'm from Maine. Maybe I can get you lobsters. And so that was almost 40 years ago, Diane St. Clair in Orwell, Vermont. She gets up every day, 7 days a week at 4 a.m. to milk the cows by 6 so that she can start making the butter, you know, that she cultured the day before, you know, make 20 pounds of butter a day.
Incidentally, I have to mention, I was reading New York Magazine recently, and there's this piece on Per Se talking about, you know, that trysts happen. You know, you're working intensely with people, and you become intimate with them. That is true for you, too.
It is.
You hired Laura Cunningham, who was your restaurant manager, really
Correct.
Your first hire mm-hmm. at the French Laundry, and she's now your partner.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can you describe that evolution?
Well, you know, it's in we work so hard and so long, so many hours, and you're right. You really become intimate with the individuals that you're working with in so many ways. And it's always kind of difficult when you begin a personal relationship with a coworker, mm-hmm. but no more so than with Laura and I. Because at the French Laundry, when we were both working at the French Laundry, every day together, we lived next door. It really became a true family kind of environment. I mean, if mother wouldn't let you do something, let's go ask father.
You have this reputation for being really very control-oriented. And in fact, you said a kitchen is about control at any level. But do you think you're any different from the top chefs? There's this element of
control.
Yeah.
We're control freaks. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, chefs, you know, historically, I mean, by nature, are control freaks. They want to control. They need to control what's going on in their kitchen so that they're controlling what's going on in the dining room. You know, we talk about emotional chefs, you know, most chefs that have outbursts and, you know, get upset. And where that comes from, I mean, the genesis of that is something happening that prevents me from giving you, the guest, the experience that I want. Because if something comes in the way of that, something clogs that, then there's a problem.
Have you in the past, like, worried, I'm not going to be very well liked if I'm going to be so control oriented? Like, did you ever have to kind of grapple with that for yourself?
Yeah, you do. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, those emotions, those emotional outbursts, you know, sometimes became personal, and you realize that that's not the way to operate. That's not respectful, and you ended up going back to the person that you had that emotional outburst, and you had to apologize to that person.
What's an example? We talk at 30,000 feet of, you know, your attention to detail and your control orientation. What's an example of that in the kitchen day to day?
Everything is about precision.
But what's an example?
Okay, an example is, let's take something as simple as knife skills. You know, cutting brunoise of vegetables. Brunoise of vegetables is something that's 1/8 of an inch square. Mm-hmm. You know, and being able to make sure that the mandoline that you have that slices the elongated piece of vegetable is really, really sharp and has the right calibration in terms of thickness. And then that your knife skills, because then your knife skills come, because then you're slicing that long, thin julienne of vegetable into a brunoise. Let's talk about quenelling.
Quenelling is
having two spoons, and quenelling is something that we do in so many different ways. It's making something in the shape of an egg. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a quenelle is something that's the shape of an egg. If you're quenelling sorbet or ice cream, you know, it really requires the sorbet or the ice cream to be a specific temperature, and it requires you to have a spoon that's clean and hot, so that when you move your spoon through the ice cream or sorbet, the sorbet just folds over itself and forms this perfect egg-shaped quenelle of ice cream. Or if you're using two spoons, when we're quenelling the caviar for the oyster and pearl, for example, making sure that you have enough caviar on the spoon and your spoons are clean and accurate, so that, and your movement back and forth to create this shape that you're then going to put on the dish, which is oysters and pearls, which is the first dish that our guests really receive and something that's so impactful for them.
Do you have the same level of precision in your personal life?
Habits are really important. So I think it's important that you recognize a certain standard. And many of us, let's take a T-shirt, for example. You may have a little hole in your T-shirt, and nobody really sees it. So is it to your standard to know that you're wearing a T-shirt that has a hole in it? Or is your standard so that you know there's a hole in it, and it's not acceptable even to you, even though no one else sees it, and you get a new T-shirt?
And what is your standard?
New T-shirt.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been the chef Thomas Keller. Coming up, we'll meet Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber, an on-demand app that allows you to order a car service using your mobile device. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an app-powered car service that helps connect drivers and passengers. The service is available in New York City, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Paris, among other cities. Travis started the company in 2010 with co-founder Garris Camp. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how does Uber work?
You get your iPhone or your Android device out, your smartphone. You push a button, and in 5 minutes, a town car arrives. You can see the car coming to you on the phone, and because you have a credit card on file with us, it truly is like your private driver, because when you get to your destination, you just walk out of the car. Mm-hmm. There's no vouchers. There's no tips already included. It's quite an elegant experience.
How did you come up with the idea?
Well, look, in San Francisco, it's very hard to get a cab. The original idea came from my co-founder. Was, I just want to push a button and get a car. And he's like, Travis, we should buy 10 Mercedes S-Classes, get 20 drivers, and lease a parking garage. And I said, Garrett, that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Now, the pushing the button and getting a car is actually pretty cool. But to be able to do that with just technology without going into owning cars and all that infrastructure was really a more efficient way of doing it.
So you had this idea. How serious was that partnership initially?
When we first got going with the business, it was really very much a lifestyle type thing. And basically the idea was really this would be for maybe 50 of our friends or 100 of our friends. It used to be you had to get a code from me to be able to use the service. And you know, my email box started overflowing with people who wanted the special code. So we just opened it up.
Now, the service has been somewhat controversial for a number of reasons, one of which is that you exist outside the, you know, the medallion system. You have, for instance, New York City taxis. The drivers work very hard to buy a medallion, which is very valuable. And here you are competing with taxis.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, right, is that what a medallion is it's a license to own and operate a cab. In the city of New York, the number of licenses to own and operate cabs has pretty much been the same since the 1940s. That makes those licenses to own and operate a taxi very valuable. In fact, now they're going for about $1 million apiece. It's very rare to have a driver that actually owns a medallion. These are not millionaires driving cars. What it is that you have investors that own the licenses typically, and they run rental car companies, which we call taxi companies, that rent the car out to taxi drivers at the, you know, a cost. It can be like, you know, as an example, like $200 a shift.
The San Francisco Metro Transit Authority issued a cease and desist order.
That's correct.
What was their issue?
There are a number of concerns they had, but I guess in California, the way it works is that the cities regulate taxis and the state regulates limousines, right? The Public Utilities Commission, the guys who regulate your water and your power, also regulate your limousines. So a cease and desist from the city doesn't have a lot of weight when it comes to a company that, which is Uber, working with a bunch of permitted, licensed limo companies, which are regulated by the state. But the name of our company was Uber Cab, and they said, well, you're marketing yourselves as a taxi company. They have jurisdiction over taxi. And so we took the cab off.
Another part of the controversy surrounding Uber is this dynamic pricing, where as the demand for cars increases, so does the price.
Yeah.
And dynamic pricing exists with hotels and airlines. How did you decide to institute dynamic pricing initially?
Right. Dynamic pricing is what we institute when there's an extreme imbalance between supply and demand. And so everybody knows, let's say in New York, around shift change, like 4 to 5 p.m. or so, all the taxis then do it, you know, then go in and they switch out drivers. So right at the time when everybody needs a taxi is the time when there are no taxis around. And if we don't raise the price, our partners, which are limo companies, will go elsewhere because there is a surge situation. They can make money elsewhere.
Uber has a rating service where the customer rates the driver and vice versa.
Yeah.
What dynamic does that create?
What's interesting about Uber is that we are completely accountable and transparent. So you get a receipt when you're done taking a ride that shows the exact route that was taken, the speed, the distance. And in addition, when you're done with the ride, you rate the driver and the driver rates you. Because of that accountability, all actors in the system act much better. Drivers love it because the riders are acting, you know, civilized, and vice versa.
You have raised capital from a number of venture capitalists, one of which is Benchmark in San Francisco. Can you tell me about that initial encounter?
I had a partners meeting there right after I had a partners meeting with Sequoia. I had an Uber take me to Sand Hill Road and drop me off at Sequoia. And I was just going to hit the button to get the Uber back and take it a mile and a half down the road to Benchmark. I finished my Sequoia meeting, opened up my app, and my Uber wasn't there. I'm stressing out a little bit because I can't go and call Benchmark that I'm going to be late because my system that I'm pitching them isn't working. What I did was I started running. I had my dress shoes on. I had my bag with my laptop, and I started running down Sand Hill Road. And I ran a mile and a half down to Benchmark from Sequoia, was about 15 minutes late, was sweating, and I'm like, what's going on? They had called my Uber while I was at Sequoia and took it off the system. It was a prank. Anyways, the meeting went really well. This is pretty rare. They put me in a separate room after the partners meeting. They met, you know, they were talked about it for about 15 minutes, and they came in the room and they wanted to do a deal right on the spot. Now, I wasn't really going to let that happen, but the next day I get to my office and there's a box on my desk, and that box was a shoe box, And those guys had bought me running shoes. And so every once in a while I might tweet out or something like that, like I've got my Benchmark shoes on today.
And did they know that you were coming from Sequoia?
They probably did because the car was right outside of Sequoia, so they could open up their app and see the car there.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an on-demand car service that helps you find a car using your smartphone. You grew up in Los Angeles,
yep.
And your background is in computer engineering. You went to UCLA. You didn't graduate from there. Before starting college, you formed an SAT tutoring company. What were your SAT scores?
Let's just say they're really high. I was like 1580.
So did you start this company?
Happened was is I started tutoring SATs in my summer between high school and college. And so it wasn't really a company at that point. But the first person I tutored went up by about 400 points. That's like going from community school to like a UC school, right? That's like a big deal. And pretty soon I was tutoring all the kids on the block, right? At some point, one of the fathers of one of the kids I was tutoring said, let's start a company.
How did you go about getting the clients?
The kid that I was tutoring was Korean background, right? Mm-hmm. And his family generally was, you know, they went to a Korean church. And so the father, which basically was my business partner, would recruit all of the kids from the Korean church. And so I was the only white guy in the school. And I learned a lot about Korean culture, but it was just kind of an interesting story.
So you were a senior at UCLA when you started your second company called Scour, which was a peer-to-peer search engine technology.
Yeah.
And that was similar to Napster, which was the music peer-to-peer sharing service, although yours incorporated more multimedia platforms, so video as well. Yeah. How did you come up with that idea?
So actually that was started by a buddy of mine, a guy named Vince Bussum. And so what happened was we would hang out at the Computer Science Undergraduate Association at UCLA, and we would do a few things. We would play Double Dragon. We would do these brain teasers, these like math brain teasers, and we would find MP3s on different FTP servers, and we would download it and play them.
MP3 being these audio files.
That's correct. If you remember way back then, if you're on a Windows 95 machine, you could not, if you had a Windows shared folder and you put files in there, there was no such thing as a firewall. Mm-hmm. Anybody could get it on the internet. So we would crawl Windows shared folders across the internet everywhere. Mm-hmm. We'd index all these files, and we had a website where you'd go type something in, like Britney Spears or Green Day or whatever. And you would get the results, you'd click, and there'd be an application that would help you download these things. The problem is there are only so many sources. There's only so much supply for these files. Mm-hmm. And we got so popular that the demand was outstripping it and therefore crashing the machines that were serving these up. So people's machines would just crash without explanation because too many people were trying to connect to it sort of remotely. Sean Fanning, who is one of our users and the co-founder of Napster, was like, I can do better than this. And so what he did was he made it so that when you went and downloaded a file, that you would automatically share it. What happened in our system, you would get a file and maybe you put it in a Windows share yourself, but he made it where it automatically shared so supply and demand would go up together. And that's why Napster became Napster.
When you realized that Sean had this little innovation,
sure.
What was your reaction?
Well, our reaction was, we're going to do that too. Mm-hmm. So he one-upped us, and then we one-upped him, and it was like this sort of arms race of technology.
Would Sean Fanning tell a compatible story to what you're telling?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, Sean Fanning is an investor in Uber.
So just as Uber has faced a degree of controversy, Scour certainly had a tempestuous start. And part of that conflict came with your early investors, one of whom was Michael Ovitz, the founder of Creative Artist Agency, CAA, and the former president of Disney. What happened there?
So Michael Ovitz did become an investor eventually. Prior to him becoming an investor, we sort of go through the process of getting an investment, which includes a term sheet. And in this case, it was a letter of intent that essentially said we couldn't shop a deal. Now, we were pretty thin on cash, running out of it, so we needed to get a deal done, but the deal just wasn't getting done. So the LOI ran out. We didn't get a deal done, and we had to go and find money somewhere. But once it was clear that we weren't going to get a deal done with their side, we basically got sued. And that is public knowledge. That was in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not really sure how the Wall Street Journal found out about it, but it was published there. And when you get a Wall Street Journal story saying that you've been sued by a guy named Michael Ovitz, you are not going to get funding anywhere. So we had one option, and that was to do the deal with him, and that's what we did.
So you were sued by him because he accused you of shopping the deal, even though the letter of intent had expired.
That's correct.
And the litigation didn't end there because you were also sued by the media companies who said that you were facilitating the stealing of their content through your peer-to-peer file sharing service.
So, look, these were the early days. Right now we have sites like YouTube where there's tons of content. It's hosted by YouTube. It's distributed. YouTube was sued by the entertainment industry as well. It's just YouTube had a lot more money to fight that. So we got sued over at Scour for $250 billion. At the time, we like to say the GDP of Sweden. And we clearly didn't have that in our back pockets. And so we filed Chapter 11 as what we like to say a strategic move. The media industry did not want copyright law to be settled in bankruptcy court in a couple weeks. And so we settled with them for $1 million cash, turned the technology off, and sold the assets of the company for $10 million, which is about what we got in funding.
And what was your psychology at the time? Here you are, you're 22 years old. Did you probably didn't expect to enter this level of turmoil?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was wild days. When you're 22 or 23 and you're going through this, you learn really quickly. But you also just come to accept that's how business is. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that's not how it is.
And then after Scour, you founded Red Swoosh, which was a content delivery network, which had its own share of problems.
Well, here's the thing, right? So we created peer-to-peer technology at Scour. We got sued for it. We went bankrupt, and we had to start over again. So the idea for Red Swoosh was let's take that beautiful technology and take those 33 guys who sued us and turn them into customers with the same stuff they sued us for. When you turn it around and turn them into a customer, you say, look, peer-to-peer is really good at distributing data efficiently at low cost. So I'm going to allow a site, we never worked with YouTube, but here's an example. Imagine going to YouTube, clicking on a link, and watching a video. But instead of that video being distributed over YouTube servers and over YouTube bandwidth, which is quite expensive, it would pull from 30 PCs that had already gotten that video content. And now YouTube, in this hypothetical situation, can save hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
And why was this period so challenging for you at Red Swoosh?
It's like I was 5 years too early to market. I started in like the Dust Bowl of the internet era, right, which was 2001. There's nothing going on. And I did 4 years without a salary. That harshness of basically, I like to say, I got 100 no's a day for 2,000 days straight, which is 200,000 no's, and you keep getting up. I still got customers, but I had to arm wrestle every single one of them to the floor to get them to do it. And it was just tough.
So now you have Uber, and life seems a bit easier than it was with your former companies. What do you see Uber becoming?
I like to say that FedEx delivers packages tomorrow. Uber delivers packages in 5 minutes. It just so happens that package is a town car that will take you wherever you want to go. But once you're delivering that package of the town car, you can deliver pretty much anything. And so we like to think that we're building an urban logistics fabric, right? A real-time supply chain. And I think that gives some sort of vision for where we think this can go.
Any interesting stories about, passengers or a story with a driver or something like that?
So our community guy in San Francisco, he does all the customer support and a lot of the local marketing in San Francisco. He gets to see everything. I mean, we have a $200 puke charge, for instance. We do suspend accounts. That does happen. When we first do it, we say, look, we hear there was some activity that had occurred. We're going to have to suspend your account. And most of the time, people understand and they move on. Sometimes people go, it was a perfectly fine ride. I don't know what you're talking about. And then you respond by saying, well, there was some, there was some word that you had done a drug deal and were attempting to solicit a prostitute while in one of our partner's cars.
And then
they usually don't say anything else.
So here you are, you are a car service and a law enforcement service.
Yeah, we definitely don't think of ourselves that way, but there, all the things that happen in the real world, this is a transportation system. These types of things can happen. And so we have to just act, responsibly in those situations.
So you have a $200 charge for people vomiting in your taxi. What about women breaking their water? I was rushing to the hospital to give birth to my first daughter, and my water broke in the taxi.
So there have been a number of Uber babies, and people tweet about it quite often. So a number of times where drivers have, taken a woman in labor to the hospital. We've never had a baby born in an Uber. That would be a beautiful thing in my book. We would not charge the customer for that situation, but we may compensate the driver.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest has been Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.